From Rome, Italy, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz joins me from Alaska, and we discuss this week's bombing at the Istanbul airport and the implications for global travel, tourism, and daily life.
With the holiday weekend, of course, coming up in this country and a lot of conversation about the number of people that will be traveling, I imagine we will see some efforts to increase security at our airports.
And later, I'll talk with former Iranian hostage John Limbert. He told me he would love to take his family back to Tehran, but says he's not welcome in the Islamic Republic.
I think I remind them of a chapter in their past they would probably like to bury, and I wouldn't let them do that.
We'll talk about his 444 days in captivity right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, I'm still in Italy. I'm in Rome, actually, and you're actually off in Alaska, having traveled to another part of the United States recently, but we're both traveling, and yet we've seen, again, some horrible news this week. I witnessed a terrible tragedy in Istanbul, killing over 30 people and wounding significantly up to 150 people. And so, again, another massive case of terrorism. But yet people are still moving around. You just flew through Dallas-Fort Worth on your way to Alaska. I'm still here in Europe traveling around. What are we to think and make of these things that keep happening? And yet, what do we do?
Well, I think that's the big question. We really don't know what to do, and short of not traveling, which I know for you and for me is not really an option, we continue to go about our daily lives, and I imagine that most people continue to do the same. We do perhaps notice heightened security. Now, I didn't notice a lot at DFW, though I imagine you are noticing some increased security there in Europe. But with the holiday weekend, of course, coming up in this country and a lot of conversation about the number of people that will be traveling, I imagine we will see some efforts to increase security at our airports in the United States. And then, of course, some discussions about what security measures should be taken in the long term. And these attacks and the ones in Brussels earlier this year really highlight the fact that it's not necessarily through security that's the issue, but that the parking lots and other areas of the airport, perhaps those are areas of concern as well. Though on the other side of that, of course, how wide can you move the periphery of a building to maintain security?
Right. Well, of course, here in Rome, the international terminal that from which the American airlines depart is probably one of the most fortified buildings in Italy. It's unbelievable. It's very difficult to get into the building. You have to go through security, or at least a passport check to even get in to the building, and then multiple checks through the building, of course, and you know, before you ever get out to your gate. The international terminal and the other terminals in Rome, not so much. Just like you've seen in Istanbul and in Brussels and in other major cities, you know, anybody can walk in the front door of those airports. But the day after the Istanbul attack, I was seeing some people off at the Rome airport in the international terminal, and it was clear that there was much more security. So, I mean, the officials are taking this seriously. I mean, it's, you know, I can honestly say people are still traveling. There are still tens of thousands of people running around the Vatican today. And, you know, we're here with students, and there's still a lot of people out on the ground, and as they should be, continuing to enjoy their lives. But our security officials, hopefully, and it seems evident to me, at least here in Rome, are not sitting back and, you know, waiting for the next thing to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be interesting to see if this affects tourism in Turkey. I think the last couple of years' events certainly have led to a decrease, but this was a very targeted attack, targeting the international terminal in particular, and then the airport writ large. We're talking about international tourists that were injured, as well as some Turkish nationals, and it looks like it may have been perpetrated, or probably was perpetrated, by people not from the Middle East, actually those that have been recruited from Uzbekistan, Russia, and elsewhere. So a very international story for sure.
Well, Turkey has taken quite a blow, not only with this attack, but previous attacks. There was the large attack in Ankara last fall. So, you know, lots of migrants, lots of people coming through, and they're being targeted. It's a major crossroads, Turkey is, for people going all over the world. And I think that's one of the reasons why we saw such tragic things happen at the Istanbul airport, because people are literally transiting through that place, going to Asia, going to Africa, coming to Europe. So it's a high target. It's a valuable target, I guess. But same was true of places like Brussels and London. I'm flying tomorrow to London, and I'm sure that security is quite significant there. So people continue to go about business as usual, and we just keep being vigilant.
Absolutely. And we'll hope that our, the security experts are able to find new ways to hopefully secure our airports and other places where these sorts of attacks may continue, and really to start looking at even more intelligence sharing. I think that's one of the issues that this hopefully is bringing to light, that ISIS is got global reach, and that it's going to take a great deal of security cooperation amongst all sorts of countries to hopefully deal with this problem. But it is concerning.
All right, Rebecca, well, enjoy Alaska, enjoy the cool weather, and I'll see you back in the United States soon.
Thanks.
If you have any thoughts about this discussion, let us know online in the Worldview section of our website. While you're there, you can subscribe to our weekly podcast. You can also follow this show on Twitter, @WorldviewsKGOU, or contact me directly @SuzekRalat. Coming up, I'll talk with Ambassador John Limbert. In 1979, he was a State Department political officer at the U.S. Embassy in Iran when students stormed the embassy and took him and 51 colleagues hostage. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. My guest, Ambassador John Limbert, spent a long career in the Foreign Service and the upper levels of the U.S. State Department. In the early 2000s, he represented the United States in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania, and later served as the first Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, focusing solely on Iranian affairs. He stepped down in 2010, frustrated that more progress wasn't made repairing U.S.-Iranian relations. On November 4, 1979, he was working as a political officer in Tehran when the U.S. Embassy was stormed by students.
The U.S. Embassy in Tehran remains occupied by Iranian students demanding extradition of the Shah and a total break in relations with America. Although as many as 100 people are being held hostage, the State Department says there's no reason to panic.
From what we have gathered, this demonstration is peaceful. And the fact that the demonstrators themselves have described this as a sit-in.
The demonstration wasn't peaceful for long, and the 52 Americans were held for 444 days. In April 1980, President Carter launched an unsuccessful rescue attempt, and in an address to the nation, he appealed to the Iranian captors to continue using restraint.
The mission on which they were embarked was a humanitarian mission. It was not directed against Iran. It was not directed against the people of Iran. It was not undertaken with any feeling of hostility toward Iran or its people.
The failure to bring the hostages home was a key issue in the 1980 U.S. presidential election, and as the Marine Band played during Ronald Reagan's inauguration, the hostages' 14-month ordeal came to an end.
For those of you just joining us, there is confirmation from the major wire services now that the American hostages are indeed aboard Algerian planes that have taken them from Tehran.
Ambassador John Limbert, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you, Suzette. It's nice to be here.
Take us back to that day 33 years ago when you were released and this incredible ordeal that you experienced. What was that like on that day?
Okay, we're talking about January 20th, 1981. It was the last day of President Jimmy Carter's administration. It was the day on which Ronald Reagan was sworn into office. We had been held since November 4th, 1979, so 14 months. When the original attack came, our priority was keeping everybody safe with the assumption that within a matter of hours or at most one day, those in authority would step in and exercise adult supervision over the situation and resolve it. Now, we might end up have stayed in Iran as diplomats. We might have left Iran under those circumstances. But what I think very few people foresaw was that this thing would change from a 1970-style student sit-in to a full-blown international crisis that would end up costing Jimmy Carter his presidency and casting a shadow over U.S.-Iran relations for the next 34 years.
So this experience that you had, I can't imagine. How did you and your colleagues endure? I mean, what did you do? Did you know what was going on in the outside world? Did you know about the rescue attempt?
We had no contact with the outside world. We had no news. We had no access to radio. We had no access to newspapers. Our mail was very limited, strictly controlled. We had very limited communication with each other. We would try to spread news. But for whatever reason, the policy of those holding us or the actions of those holding us were to keep us isolated from news of the outside. I felt perhaps they felt we would be more malleable or more manipulatable because of that.
Okay, so the day comes and you're ready to go. I mean, did this come as a huge shock the day that you were released? Had you lost hope about being released?
No, we never lost hope. There had been some false signs before that things might change. So you didn't deliberately get your hopes up too high because you knew that something could go wrong, there could be a problem. But there were two major indications that something major was going on. One was the visit approximately a month before we were released by an Algerian mediation team. There was an official from the Algerian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and then the Algerian ambassador in Tehran who came around, visited us, and told us in general terms what was going on, not specifics, not who was saying what or who was bargaining what. But this was certainly a very positive sign. It was the most positive sign that we had seen in a long time because these were serious people. And the fact that they had visited us, the students who were holding us either allowed them to do it or were forced to allow them to do it and had no choice. And so the sign was something serious is in the works and there looks like a change going on. Put that together with the change of administration in the United States, and there was reason for hope.
I'm speaking with Ambassador John Limbert, who was one of the 52 Americans taken hostage at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979. We'll talk about his desire to return to Iran right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest, Ambassador John Limbert, was one of 52 Americans held captive in Iran from 1979 to 1981. So clearly since that time and your release, I mean, you've gone on to have a significant career in the Foreign Service and particularly throughout other parts of the region in the Middle East. How was that for you to return back to the region? And have you ever made it back to Iran?
I've never been back to Iran since that. This is not my choice. I would like to go back. I would like to take our children back because they were both born there. Would like to take our grandchildren back there because it's part of them. But so far, I'm not welcome.
And that's meaning not welcomed
by the Iranians.
You would not be welcomed there because of that.
That's right. Yeah. American tourists go. American visitors go.
So there's no prohibition for you to go from our perspective.
No,
the US
there's no
government.
There's no thing. I'm a private citizen. I don't work for the State Department anymore. So there's no prohibition on it. Why this is so, I don't know. I think I remind them of a chapter in their past they would probably like to bury, and I wouldn't let them do that if I were there. I would be a walking reminder, forcing them to confront something that they would prefer not to. In terms of my career, I went back to working in the Foreign Service because it's what I do. It's what I know. And the experience reinforced the idea that this is important, that diplomacy is important, that talking among states is important, because during those 14 months, we had all witnessed firsthand the alternative, that when communication breaks down, the alternative, frankly, is anarchy, violence, and lawlessness. Now, the international arena, the stage for international relations, is already a pretty chaotic place in the best of circumstances. But when you remove every vestige of order and rule, then what are you left with? You're left with a kind of very, I call it Hobbesian universe, in which only the strong survive, and there is nothing to protect anyone else. It's ironic, really, that during all this, the Iranians kept saying that they didn't care about international law. They didn't care about international organizations, international structures. But those structures are there to protect the smaller countries. Presumably, the superpowers, the large powers, don't need them quite as much. It's countries like Iran that, in fact, need that kind of in need of that kind of protection.
So it only hurts them to not participate in these international organizations and abide by international law.
Well, the whole incident, the whole incident was for Iran and Iranians was incredibly self-destructive. I mean, you start to catalog, but just one example was the Iran-Iraq War. Saddam looked at Iran. He saw this country that was isolated, that was in turmoil, that was tearing itself apart. And correctly, he estimated that when he attacked, no one or almost no one in the international community would take Iran's side.
So critical mistake made by Iran.
Well, if they were thinking that way. I mean, we don't.
So I guess
live
a critical strategic mistake.
That's right. We don't live in a rational world. I wish we did, but we pretend we do sometimes. But we don't. And these were not decisions taken on the basis of a measured consideration of national interest.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about your passion now. I mean, obviously that experience, the passion that you have for diplomacy and open channels of communication and working together in that respect. So let's fast forward to today. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, after this crisis, damaged relations, Iran-U.S. relations, you know, have pretty much been non-existent since that time. But where are we headed today? I mean, as a diplomat, do you see that there's some hope for normalized relations now, particularly in light of a change of regime in Iran? Is the U.S. now more interested in redeveloping those ties? Where do you think we're headed today?
As a diplomat, my profession demands that I always be an optimist, that I always see something better out there. If you're not an optimist, you're probably in the wrong field. You shouldn't be in this field. You should be in something else. The fact of the matter is that for 34 years, the U.S. and Iran barely talked to each other. And if we did talk to each other, it was usually yelling at each other or calling each other names, insulting each other, threatening each other, sometimes worse than that. Where are we headed? Well, clearly something is changing. After the election of Hassan Rouhani in Iran, the Iranians have undertaken a new direction. The election of Barack Obama in 2008 set the United States in a new direction, where President Obama used language and styles toward Iran that had not been heard in a long time. For 5 years, however, there was not a positive response to that. And so what you have now is a coincidence, call it a fortunate coincidence, of two leaders who seem to have some common features in their vision of the relationship. Until now, you haven't had that. You had, if one side seemed interested in changing the relationship, making some progress, the other side pulled back. It could have been bad luck, bad coincidence, bad timing, whatever it was. When under President Clinton, when the U.S. reached out in 1997, 1998, the Iranians pulled back. In 2003, the Iranians came forward with a plan. The Bush administration wasn't interested. In 2009, President Obama came forward with his ideas. The Iranians were not very responsive. Now you have a situation where it's possible that the two sides could actually talk, could come together at the same time. Because after all, President Obama 5 years ago spoke about engagement based on mutual interest and mutual respect, something that the Iranians had always said they wanted. 5 years later, President Rouhani is now talking about moderation. Even the Supreme Leader is talking about flexibility. This is new in the political vocabulary. And so you have a coincidence of leadership with certainly not the same vision, but at least similarities in their visions of how this relationship might go.
So potentially not opening the door for a better future laying ahead, I suppose. That's the optimistic view.
Well, what we have is maybe the door isn't open. Maybe the window isn't open, but maybe there's a small crack in this wall of mistrust and suspicion and hostility that's divided us for over three decades.
Well, it certainly will be interesting to see how this develops and how this kind of, you know, coming together and the timing of these two leaders at one time might play out. Well, thank you, Ambassador Limbert, for sharing your story with us today. It's very inspiring, and I appreciate you being here to share this with us.
Well, thank you, Suzette. My pleasure.
You've been listening to my conversation with Ambassador John Limbert, a longtime diplomat who was held captive in Iran during the 1979 hostage crisis. During the ordeal, Limbert met with the future Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and we have that video on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview, Sam Dupre produces the show, and Brian Hardzinski produces our digital content. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.